Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 27th, 2006. Today's session is entitled, This is the Beginning, Not the End, from Matthew 24, verses 4 through 8. Presenter is Michael Pellet. Number is POM2006-08. Let's listen in.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. This is our second session looking at Matthew chapter 24. Talk about the end of the world. And what we're going to try to do this week is think about notions of the end of the world, or as I want to have us think about it, living between the two resurrections, the resurrection of Jesus and our own resurrection, and what that means, and that end of, and what the end of the world means in the light of our theme and our theme verses for this year. Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 to 20. And so again, I will simply read Matthew 28, 16 to 20, so we get a sense of the theme that's there, that will be kind of the glasses we use to read Matthew 24. Matthew 28 reads, Now the 11 disciples came to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had appointed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, though they also doubted. And Jesus came up and spoke to them, saying, All authority has been given to me in heaven and upon the earth. So, get a move on. Disciple all the nations, baptizing them into the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to keep all things which I have commanded you. And, pay attention now, I with you am all the days until the consummation of the age. And that's my own translation. And I guess a footnote, and this is also a plug because I get big royalties from this. If you want to know why I've translated it this way and what that all entails, 2 weeks ago I led the Bible study on those verses, Matthew 28, 16 to 20. So they have taped sessions of that in the resource library if you have a hard time sleeping and what, just get a tape and you'll be off dozing in no time. Okay, so with those verses in mind, we started looking at Matthew chapter 24, verses 1, 2, and 3. So, to pick it up where we left off yesterday. Jesus was walking away from the temple. Jesus had turned his back on the temple, giving us this understanding that now the presence of God is no longer simply in the temple and all that the temple stood for. So we had listed on the board yesterday the political, the economic, the social, the religious, the theological, the educative, and all sorts of understandings of the temple. And then looked at that in terms of saying, okay, right, Matthew is giving us kind of a picture. Jesus now is the focal point, making that claim of presence, I am with you, and the temple was that horizon within we gain the perspective. And then we ask, what happens when that horizon comes crashing down? And Tom Smith helped us out. One way to think about that is we have vertigo. total disorientation. How do we do that? And we talked about then for us in our contemporary situation, what is that horizon, and kind of talked about that as a scientific, technological, industrial, economic horizon. And what happens when that comes crashing down? Not because of its failure, but because of its success. That we are so successful that we have actually achieved ourselves into disaster, into destruction. What's left? How do we see that and understand that? That's where I want to pick it up. And therefore, we're going to start kind of in verse 3. Jesus is on the Mount of Olives. So if you will, the presence of God has moved from the temple with Jesus now. Again, to keep chapter 28 in mind there, we're on the Mount of Olives. And again, for Matthew, mountains are very important. For Matthew, mountains come up 7 times. So of course, we have to have a quiz. The 6th time for a mountain in Matthew's gospel is the Mount of Olives. I'll give you the easy answer. Where are the other 6 times that we have mountains in Matthew's gospel? That's the second easiest answer. Right. Sermon on the Mount.
Transfiguration.
I think I won't put that about there. The temptation.
Golgotha.
No. Matthew doesn't really want to call that a mountain. Actually, transfiguration will go. Now we're getting to a fiction.
Well, the Great Commission.
The Great Commission, the last one, right? Matthew 28, our theme verse. Now come the 2 tough ones. Feeding, yeah. Which feeding? Is it the 5? Is it the 4?
The multitude.
Which one?
What does he mean?
Feeding of the 4,000. The 5,000 were on the plain. The 4,000 is on the mountain. The 5,000 were, if you will, for Israel. The 4,000 was an understanding of the Gentiles. And again, that would be kind of revelatory, and we can link that up with Matthew 28 in that sense of all nations. Here, foreshadowing how all nations were fed. The last one happens after the feeding. This, of course, it would be the most difficult one. Jesus goes up to the mountain to pray. So there are the mountains. And of course, the symbolism, the imagery of the mountain is again, going back to Mount Sinai, kind of the Uber mountain of mountains, which is always the place of God's revelation, the place of God's teaching, the place of God's covenant. And certainly for Matthew, when Jesus is on a mountain, you can always say, ah, a teachable moment, right? That's what's going
to
happen.
Is it getting too off to ask, why is it feeding on the mountain for Gentiles rather than Israel? Then,
in terms of why this becomes a teachable
for Gentiles rather than for...
Precisely because the understanding and opening of God's promises for all people and all nations. The Gentiles are also included.
And the plain says Israel, boy.
Yeah.
Can't do it briefly.
Well, no. We'll talk afterward, okay? I'll be happy to talk about that some more. Okay, now we're at the Mount of Olives. So now this, too, is going to be a teachable moment as, again, the disciples talk about when and what, when is the end of the world, what are the signs? And again, the presence of Jesus is at this, on the Mount of Olives. What happens when everything comes crashing down? The other little thing that helps us understand and put this together about the Mount of Olives, and I know Fred knows the answer to that, so I don't want him to say it, is what is located on the Mount of Olives? Does anybody know?
Olives.
Olives. Yeah, you remember. The Mount of Olives is also a cemetery. Right. So the kind of thing here is we are again talking about the end, right, in the cemetery, or the place where there is a cemetery. A place, obviously, of death. And certainly, that would be a good time to talk about ends, because death seems to be an end and all that that includes. And so there, the disciples, again, if things come crashing down, and all of those things, we talk about the end. And when will this end be? And here again, talking about that, the disciples ask, you know, when will be your coming? This is in verse 3. And the Greek word for that is parousia. Again, a technical term in the sense that the technical term was that this was usually understood as a visit of state in terms of when the emperor would come to town, that would be a parousia, right? A very special high-level occasion and visit, right? If the president comes to Holden Village, that would be that would be Trump. But it would be a parousia. The other thing, in general, back to classical Greek, parousia simply means present. It is the presence or the being of being there. It's simply your presence. And so again, the disciples are asking, yes, when Jesus will be this end, and when will there be this kind of visit of state, this special way of doing it? But the other way is just simply, when will be your presence? And it would seem to be a good question to ask is, where is your presence in the cemetery? Where is your presence in death? So that again, that whole sense of, we may think about this in very glorious terms, but the tough questions are saying, where is God? Where is Jesus? When it seems God, Jesus are absent. Because that's all the questions about the when and the what, right? Give us some signs, tell us when, because for us, the problem that we seem to be encountering is absence. Everything comes crashing down, and you say, well, focus on me, but how are we going to do that if you're not there? you're not here, when are you going to be here? So we know where to look, where to find you. And again, being on the Mount of Olives in the cemetery, if you will, heightens that kind of understanding. Matthew, I believe, has already talked about that in many different ways. But one place where he already gives us a sign of that, I think, that may not be quite as apparent to us, is already on the Sermon on the Mount in the Beatitudes. If someone, please, would turn to Matthew chapter 5, verse 3. And read that for us. Matthew 5, 3.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah. What does that have to say about what we're talking about at the cemetery? First of all, kingdom of heaven, reign of God. Let's think about that in terms of the notion of presence. Because where there is God's reign, God's rule, that is indeed Christ's reign and rule. That is where God's presence is. So you could already say, blessed are the poor in spirit, for God's presence is with them. There is God's presence. Okay? Poor in spirit. And again, Luke just says the poor. And sometimes we like that because that seems to be more physical and real, because poor in spirit seems like we can spiritualize that away. I don't think that's really where Matthew's going with that. Poor, it's a great onomatopoetic word in Greek. It's ptosi.
Right. Do that again.
Ptosi. I'll spell that for you. That PT, right, that really, you know, if you're lecturing, you want to make sure you're close to people.
Right.
But of course, you know, it's the action of spitting, and why not? We always spit on the poor, don't you? Literally, it's a word that means to cringe or to cower. Because think about that in terms of the reaction, you know, if I'm going to spit on Paul, he's probably going to cringe and cut it. So the poor in spirit are those who are cringing and cowering. And of course that means too their spirits, their being is crushed. And that is both, if you will, a physical and a spiritual sense there. Matthew is not taking away the physical side of this. The poor in spirit, then, are those who are cringing and cowering. Those are the ones who are totally dependent upon someone or something else because they've been totally broken. Right? They're the ones we spit on. They're the ones who are crushed, Fred.
Also, if you take it totally literally, panorama is breath, the people who have run out of breath, which takes us back to the cemetery.
Right.
That's where the realm of God is.
Right. So that's another way of saying that if you're the poor in spirit, you're the out of breath ones. Yeah. And so in that sense, again, blessed are the totally crushed, the cowering, the dependent, the out-of-breath ones. I'm with you. That's where I am. That's where you will find God. That's where Christ is present. So that already preliminarily, when you ask, well, Jesus, when will be these signs of the end? Well, when you're dead, when you're crushed, when you're out of breath. And what are the signs? Well, look for those places of death, of brokenness, of absolutely nothing left. And that's where you will find me. Indeed, that paradoxical thing, in those places where you think I would be most absent, in those places where your first question is, where is God? That's where you'll find me. Again, those of you who have been around for last week's Bible study that Fred led, he talked about that using Elie Wiesel's book, Night, and that illustration there from the boy on the gallows. For us, asking that question that Wiesel asks, where is God? We would say, there on the gallows, in that situation. That's what cross is for us as followers of Jesus. Where is God? On the cross, in the depths. And again, that's nothing new. Here, in that sense, Jesus and Matthew are simply making the Hebrew Scriptures come alive. Two examples of that from the Psalms, if you want to look at that. Psalm 121. If you would look at Psalm 121, verse 1 and verses 5 to 8. And again, if somebody finds that, if they would read it for us.
I lift up my eyes to the hill. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth.
Okay, in verses 5 to 8, please. Or did you read that?
No. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time on and forevermore.
So you start out with that question, where in all that absence? And the thing is, well, where? God is your people. God is the one there with you. Psalm 130, verses 1 and 2, and then verse 7, please. Again, if someone would read that.
Out of the depths I cry to thee, O Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Let thy ears be attentive to the voice of my supplication.
Then verse 7.
O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is steadfast love, and with him is plenteous redemption.
So again, you start out in the depths, the bottom of the mountain, if you will, or in the cemetery, and the word of reassurance of presence says, hope in the Lord, hope in God, for God is with you. Again, I think the understanding there is never, okay, you're down there in the valley, you're down there in the depths, and what do you have to do? Lift yourself up by your bootstraps and climb on up to God. But it's always the sense God comes down to be with you. God's presence is there with you where you are, down in the valley as you lift your eyes to the hills, there in the depths
as you wonder, where will my help come? And so, at the beginning here of Matthew, he wants us to see that as well. That as we ask those questions, where is Christ? As we live between those two resurrections, with us, but with us in those places where we least expect it, where we ask where, and where it seems that there's nothing but absence. Okay? Let's move on then and look at verses 4 through 8. We're going to be more specific now. The disciples have asked, when will this end be? What are the signs? And so in verses 4 through 8, Jesus begins to give us an answer to that. So if someone would read verses 4 through 8, please.
And Jesus answered them, "Take heed that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All this is but the beginning of the birth pangs."
All right, thank you. So, did Jesus answer the question?
No. When things come crashing down.
Yeah. But when things come crashing down, what is that? Is that the end?
No.
No, that's the beginning. But I wanted a sign about the end. I wanted a sign about the end, and Jesus gave us all these things and said, no, this is not the end, this is the beginning. Well, thanks for answering the question, Jesus. What about a sign? Did Jesus in these 4 or 5 verses give us any sign?
It sounds like now.
Now!
That's the explanation. That's what my grandpa said when he was living.
Right?
Anybody else? Any signs? Basically telling the disciples, the sign is all signs are false. All those who claim that this is the sign. Oh, you know, there's Hurricane Katrina, and there's those earthquakes over there in Pakistan, and there's global warming. Oh, must be the end of the world. No, it's the beginning. You know, all tele-evangelists, you know, Jimmy Swaggart and Benny Hinn and Robert Tilton. Oh, nah, it's the beginning, not the end. All those folks who claim signs, right? Jack Van Impe, who knows all the signs, doesn't know anything. No, that's what it says, right? Those folks know nothing. They are, right, to put it in terms of the hard language that's there, false teachers. Verse 4, Jesus' first answer. Be always on the lookout that no one causes you to wander. Beware, that's the first thing. Be on the lookout. Keep your eyes peeled for all those who cause you to wander. And the word for wandering there, it says led astray. It's more a sense of wander, planes, from which we get the word planet. And what planet literally means is a wandering object. Be aware of those who would cause you to become wandering objects. And again, you got to think about the kind of Ptolemaic solar system, because the planets didn't have nice circular orbit. You know, they were kind of circular, but it didn't quite work, so they had to have a little epicycle where they go, and then it'd be okay, right? But they had a wander, they had to wiggle a little bit. That's the closest I come to dancing. And that's the thing. Be careful that you're not a wandering object. Because that's what these teachers will cause you to do, to wander. And remember again, to keep in mind those first verses there, the focus is Christ. So therefore, be aware of all of those who would cause you to wander from Christ, from Christ's presence. It's in the present tense, and that means then that that's a task of constant vigilance. It's something that we always keep doing. You can't do it once, and it'll go away. You can't do it and say, well, we got rid of Jimmy Swaggart, so we won't have to worry about that anymore. No, there'll be somebody else coming along, right? Trying to sell you that kind of snake oil and what's there.
Well, don't the televangelists kind of hang everything on verse 8? This isn't the end, but it's the beginning of the end.
We'll look a little more closely at verse 8 in just a minute to see again what's going to be happening there about, I think, a different understanding of that. The other notion that's there is to say, why do all of these false teachers, these teachers about the end of the world, why do they get away with that? Basically, I think the implication is here is because people are gullible. And why are we gullible? How do we play on the gullibilities of folks? Because of our curiosity about the future. Right? We want to know. You want to know about the end? How it works? Okay, I'll give you the secret code. M-I-C-K. That wasn't even recalled. All those poor folks who would ever, if anyone ever listens to us, they'll never know. But isn't that how it works? And you think now that somehow you have been able to gain security. And to go right back to our old illustration again, what happens here is, right now, instead of the temple, back here is our horizon or our own contemporary situation. Now what becomes the idol that we set up there is somehow our notion of security and a sense of security for the future. But again, the irony there. Everybody's looking for security for their future, and Jesus is talking to them in the cemetery. Right? That's the thing you can be sure of. You'll own a plot.
I have a question. It says on the Mount of Olives they came to him privately. Is that the text that the scripture refer to as a group of private disciples or one by one? What's the answer to your question?
Oh, I want to know. I think it's the group of disciples. But that's an interesting point in terms of the
the inference there seems to be, this is not a public statement for everyone. This is the concern that was raised by the disciples, if you will. This is the concern raised by the community of faith because they're feeling Christ's absence. So they want to know. So that in that sense, you could say that these words, these teachings are specifically addressed to the church, if you want to put it that way. I think that's what the privately there designated. I don't know, Fred, if you want to say anything more about to whom you think the audience is of chapter 24.
The truth is I was side-talking with Ingrid.
These were all Jews, and they had come out of a Jewish tradition where everything was really well prescribed and ordered, and there were good bases for all this. It's not surprising that they asked this question.
Oh, no, that's right. Yeah, certainly they would ask that question of their teacher, of
that's
their
right.
rabbi.
And they would be told by the rabbi, this is what you do, this is what you do, this is what you do, this is what will happen.
Yeah. And he's not doing that.
No.
What a lousy rabbi. Yes, Jeshua.
I'm just kind of perpetually frustrated with this description of the times because I can't think of a time in modern or recent history or any time where this hasn't been true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like a joke. It's just a practical joke. It's like, you know, I'm just going to describe something that's... I mean, if you're going to pick anything that's ongoing, this is it.
Mm-hmm. And yet someone will always say, see, given these signs, it's going to be the end. That's why I'm saying again the kind of gullibility of people that's there, but what would make them that gullible? That curiosity or even fear with regard to the future, and that sense is somehow, can we get a handle on it? Can we have a sense of security? And if you will, that's what these folks promise. But of course, that's a false promise. They can't give you any security.
And doesn't it even go one step further than security? It's almost a Gnostic notion that if you have knowledge of the future, you can control it.
Right.
And then you become godlike.
Right. And that leads precisely then into verse 5, the implication that the false teacher is the one who is going to say, I am the Christ. I am the Messiah. And again, I don't read that literally that they have to go around saying, I am the Messiah. But it's precisely that implication. If I can give you knowledge about the future, that you can have that security and you know, hey, you know, really, I'm the one that gives you the power of how to save. I'm the Messiah in that sense. I am the Christ. And so they are the ones who truly take the place of Christ. The other thing about this, and then this is, again, my little aside, but to think about this and all these folks who think they know about the future, to put it into highfalutin philosophical terms, the question here about the future and what we want to know is, can people know future contingent particulars? Right. A future contingent particular is, well, am I going to get rich next year, right? I mean, those are the kinds of things for fortune tellers, that they'll tell you all the little future contingent particulars. Oh, I see in your future someone coming into your life. A career change, right? All of those things. But the thing is, you know, and you think, wow, you know, and that's a, what a skill or something that these people may have. You think about it, future contingent particulars, the odds are pretty easy you'll be right. It's a 50-50 split, right? Future contingent particular is flip a coin. Will it be heads or tails? That's it. I mean, far better odds predicting the future than you'll ever get at Las Vegas. Right? Because think about that. Oh, Bob, I see for you a career change.
Well, I got a 50-50 chance. I mean, either his career is going to change or it won't. It's heads or tails. I mean, big deal, right?
Paul. Isn't the odd thing that I was thinking about future contingent particulars, and someone like Hal Lindsey, the late great Planet Earth, who in 1971 said that the common market would increase to 10 members and 10 beasts to the apocalypse, because that's the way it was going, but then Norway didn't join the common market, so it was a nine-headed beast of the apocalypse, and his future contingent particulars were wrong, and people still believed it.
Yeah.
And they still do. People still buy that book.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess when you're thinking about the future, close counts.
Can you get a cigar?
It wasn't 10, it was 9, close enough. Let's go for it, huh? I know. I think, again, it's that sense of people's security, right? Our desire to somehow have some notion of controlling the future, controlling our lives, and having power over it, that we pretty much check out in terms of our reason that point and become extremely gullible. Again, Jesus' words there, right? Always be on the lookout. Keep your wits about you. Think about this kind of thing and recognizing, again, the kinds of things that are happening there, the kinds of claims that are being made. And so here, Jesus' first response to the question about the signs is to discourage us from even thinking about signs and asking that kind of question. If you will, to ask the question, what are the signs about the end? Jesus' first response is, wrong question. That's not the question, because that will get you nowhere. That will be nothing but deception. And in that sense, we're in trouble. The other thing, and this is somewhat distressing, and again, in verse 5, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and they will lead many astray. Again, if you will, the word here is, these folks are going to be tremendously successful. And the least that will do to the rest of us is frustrate us. But it might do something more. It might cause us to say, are they right? Because look at everybody. Many are going over there. Could they be wrong? Maybe this is the way to go. What do we do in response to that?
Michael, could you comment on the delay of the parousia issue in the early church and the reality of all kinds of messiahs arising and the struggle given the Jewish understanding of the work of the Messiah?
Sure. let me keep that right here in the context to say again, the question here, what we're talking about, the delay or whatever, I'll keep it here at this moment, at the community level, but existential level, is we're down here, we're the poor, we're the spit upon, we're the cowering, we're the people out of breath, and oh, we are the poor in spirit and are experiencing, it seems to be, the absence of Christ. And are asking, are there any signs? Are there any clues when this is going to end? Can you give us a hint, Jesus? And the response here is, again, twofold. First, to remember in that opening context to say, when everything comes crashing down, there's where my presence will be. In that absence, if you will, a kind of paradoxical notion, the presence of Christ in with that absence. And then
trying to say, and now, watch out, because all these other folks are going to try to deceive you and trick you. And what's our only defense against that? I think it's simply the gospel itself. When you see there are many false prophets and many people going over there, what do? You preach the gospel. You can look at that minimally and maximally in the same sense to say, that's all we've got. We've got the presence of Christ in the Word. Word, capital W there. And that's it. You can say, oh, that's not much. I think Jesus' response is, it's more than enough. It is sufficient.
Michael, is there any import in the phrase, for this must take place?
Yes, there is. That Greek word of must or necessity. Kind of notion there of saying that this is necessary, but I don't think that is in terms of, you know, sometimes you can read necessity in terms of a determinism or a fatalism. I don't think that's where the text is taking us. The necessity here is, again, to go back to Matthew 28, when Jesus says, all authority is given to me, that necessity there, the authority is there, is to say, even though all of this is happening, remember, God is in charge. And all of this is still happening under the reign and rule of Christ. Now, how that all works out in everything, again, we don't know. We don't know the future and control that. But the sense there is, this is still under God's reign and rule. And that's, I think, the sense of must.
Well, I'm still thinking about Joshua's point that these signs don't seem very specific. Well, whenever you see a stop sign, there are a zillion stop signs. But I wonder partly what the force of that isn't, the answer to the question of when isn't a specific time, but whenever. Whenever you see these signs. And you'll always see these signs, so stop worrying about when it's going to happen, because it happens. It is happening.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If, as you said in the earlier part, where does God find us? It's when we're poor in spirit. Well, that's not a specific time. It's always that.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. But I think there are also times, right? I mean, there are times, let's keep it at the individual level, there are certainly times in our lives when we might feel more poor in spirit at one time than at another. And I think here, what we're saying is for the community, the Christian community can feel certain times when that notion of end seems to be more imminent than others.
But it doesn't change God's way of being in the world. So in your list of things people turn to signs, you didn't talk about 11, and yet remember how many people said, oh, now the world is different. And I remember my response was, no, it's not different, you just noticed it. No, you noticed that America isn't invulnerable. It wasn't that we weren't before. And there's a similar way with these signs. It's not that the world changes, but that we notice something that was already true.
Yeah. My way of talking about 9/11 is it's a
again, an incident of good old-fashioned evil. It's nothing new. It's just good old-fashioned evil showing itself one more time.
I still come back to the fact that I feel like Jesus is up to no good. I mean, it's not unlike if your eye causes you to sin, you take it out. I mean, it's the same. Kind of every once in a while, he throws in a ridiculous suggestion that makes it. I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, and so you see people just foolishly going around trying to figure out exactly what that means. But that's what this statement, I mean, I never really even thought about that, but that's what this statement is like to me. It's just ridiculous.
Which statement is
this,
that?
This right here, you'll see, you know, nations rising up against nations. And I mean, it's the same thing.
As what?
As always.
As you know, take if your eye causes you to sin, take it out. But you can't do that, and there will always be nations against nations. So the same kind of.
Isn't it ironic, though, that there's such a focus on the end, but in this life, it's full of small endings all the time, and ages are always ending. I guess as I get older, I stop and I think back to when I was a kid, and that world doesn't exist anymore. The grown-ups of that time don't exist, and a lot of the memories of that time are fading fast, and so ages are always ending. And life, as we know it, is full of small endings and calamitous endings. So to ask for the end seems to posit everything into one basket mm-hmm. and ignore the constant reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me say a few things about this, again, this sense of the whole here. One way to read this. And if you will, I'm going to be unabashedly Lutheran for a moment, so forgive
like
me
if that has to happen.
From the Lutheran Confessions. Lutheran Confessions say the way in which you interpret things and understand the scriptures is that, first of all, the reading and interpretation of the scriptures is going to be Christocentric. Christ is the center. The other thing is that the scriptures will always have a pastoral component to them. And that is, again, in Lutheran Confessions language, it is the comforting of the terrified conscience. And isn't that what's happening in verses 4 through 8? Verses 4 and 5, I understand, is Christocentric. Always be on the lookout for anybody who would want to take you off center from Christ. Right? That's, if you will, the theological side of this. The second part, as Jeshua and others have brought, is a pastoral concern. Right? Trying to comfort the terrified conscience. All those folks who are going to say, oh, be scared, be worried, be terrified. It's the end of the world. Look at, there's earthquakes, there's wars, there's this, that. And you go, yeah, yeah, sure, sure. We know. But, you know, tell me something new. But in that sense, right, don't be terrified by what terrifies others is kind of what's said here. If you will, it's a word of comfort. Or to be even crazier, we've got an exorcism going on. And what is being cast out here in all the exorcisms that happen is fear. Right? What Christ does, what the gospel does, is it casts out fear. Right? That's why Jesus always keeps saying, stop being afraid.
Yeah. And it casts out false claims and their power over us,
right.
Which is also demonic.
Which is also demonic. That would take us back to the Christocentric. So the exorcism is, if you will, the demons are any forces or whatever that would want to take something other than Christ as center And then the second part, the pastoral side, is the fear, the terrified conscience. And you know, some folks, you know, oh, my terrified conscience, boy, it's that old stuff. Who has that anymore? We all do, right? It's what every newscast does to make ratings. The first story is always a terrified conscience story. Murder is up in the Twin Cities. You can't walk out on the streets anymore, can you? Because, you know, all your next door neighbors are psychopaths. You live next to me. No. Right? I mean, basically, one of the things that's projected by the media is fear, right? People be afraid. You know, Bob brought that, you know, again, bird flu, SARS, every, we get killed all the time by these potential epidemics that are there, right? What the world is telling us is people be afraid. And this is where Jesus is saying, stop being afraid. And here he's casting out that fear by saying, you know, all those things that make you afraid, you know, quite frankly, they are somewhat common, ordinary, everyday events. Yeah, they happen. It's called life. But I am with you. Don't think I'm absent. Don't think I'm not around. I am with you. One last thing. In that notion about nation will rise up against nation. The word for raise up there that Matthew uses is the same word that is used when God raises Jesus up from the dead. And I think at least then for those readers and hearers hearing that word, they would say, yes. Nation rising up against nation, lifting up against nation, can be bad news. But we also know of a different raising up. We know of another raising up. When God raised up Jesus from the dead. And that's the raising that we remember. Because that's raising up over death. That's raising up over all our fears. That's the raising up over all those times when we think God is absent and gone. Be not afraid. It is just a door. Right? But it's that sense, I think, that notion of raising up that Jesus is, right, assuring his disciples that that's what's there. I said that was the last word. I lied. One more. Labor pains. At the very end there. Odinon can be translated as labor pains. It's also, again, not usually in the New Testament, but in classical Greek, it's also understood as the death rattle. So that, again, you can see how that fits in with the end of the world. But both labor pains, death rattle, can fit in here. I'll stick with labor pains. The traditional one in the sense about labor pains. I think labor pains in this context is both good news and bad news. First of all, labor pains is bad news or negative because women, as you well know, when you begin labor pains, you go, uh-oh, more pain ahead. But it's also good news. Because when you begin labor pains, you go, there will be birth. There will be new life. And so those labor pains are times of fear for us, trepidation, uh-oh, more pain ahead. But they are also a time of joy. Yes?
I'm thinking back that many centuries, and I'm wondering if there was that sense of so much promise that we know today with the death rate at birth.
Yeah.
Was it so much promise until that child was actually there?
Yes, but that child isn't going to get there until you have those labor pains.
No, but what I'm saying is that I think back in those days there would even been more fear than there is today, because you don't know whether the mother and child are going to make it through those labor pains.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I see what you're saying. That's right. Yes.
I mean, today we can say, oh, yeah, it's going to hurt a lot, but I don't have a baby yet. You didn't have that promise so clearly.
So you could say, in that sense, the greater the fear, the greater the joy.
That's true.
If you make it without making it through. Any other comments that you want to make on any of these things or questions?
I wonder if we can correlate the false teacher image of those you listed to bigger parts of our society, offering answers, of course, you know. Not, they may not say we are the Christ, but certainly we can offer you security. We are the answer.
Yes.
Yes. Whatever we are.
I think we can, but I think in at least in this particular section, if to say Jesus is addressing the community of faith, kind of if you will, the biggest difficulty the church faces, Jesus seems to be saying here, are the false teachers within it. You say, yeah, you got all sorts of problems outside, but hey, you know, if you want to look at it, the enemy is truly within. That's the one that'll really mess things up. It seems that that's where the focus is here in these opening verses. But I wouldn't disagree with you. Of course, there are all sorts of others who will claim to be Messiah.
Excuse me. Are you going to get to the end of chapter 24?
This is but the beginning. Yes.
It's harder and harder for me to kind of read it with this interpretation. I mean, the further in you get, it seems it's harder to say this is to exercise the fear.
No, that's a good question. Yes, we will work our way through chapter 24. Well, let's try Friday. Does that work? We should get to the end of 24 by Friday.
Who knows the hour?
Thank you, Carla. That's probably true. Our time's up for today.